Imagine you're a steel company boss, and steel tariffs are the president's favorite trade policy. How you doing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 5th day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, sometimes when there's news, you know right away who you got to talk to about it. So on Monday, which I know feels very long ago, but Monday, when President Trump said seemingly out of nowhere that he was going to put steel and aluminum tariffs on Brazil and Argentina, I said, Lisa Goldenberg, we got to call Lisa Goldenberg. She is, as you may remember, the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania, and she is one of our, hey, how are things going regulars. So we got her on the phone. Lisa, it's been a couple of days, but it is good to talk to you again.
Wonderful to speak with you as well. Happy holiday.
And to you. So I'm sure that the other day when the president announced those new tariffs, the steel tariffs on Brazil and Argentina, your ears perked up just as ours did.
Oh, my goodness. I was at a dinner with a bunch of Brazilians, would you imagine? And it was a tweet, not an announcement, let's
that
be clear.
True. That is true.
So everybody was literally staring at each other. It was just sort of like it fell from the sky.
So is it going to complicate an already complicated life for you? I imagine it will.
Sure. It depends on which end of the stick you're on. So if you have steel on the water coming from South America, the price you paid, regardless of your contract or your agreement, is now 25% higher. I do not have any steel on the water, but you are obligated 25% more. And most of the purchases made internationally are under contract. So you're never going to get that money. Yeah. You can't pass that on to the consumer. You have to eat that difference in most cases. For someone like me, when the tariffs are put into place, it sends the domestic market kind of kaflooey and prices run up. So it's the timing is interesting because first quarter is usually pretty strong in steel. We usually come back from holiday and things are moving. A lot of people have a year end at the end of December. They run down their inventories. Manufacturing, a lot of people close between Christmas and New Year's, so you lose a lot of shipping days. And now prices are running up and people are scrambling to buy steel. It's goofy.
I imagine your Brazilian dining partners, their faces must just have fallen, right? And just gone, oh my God, what are we
doing? Yeah. It puts them in a – it's exactly what we've discussed so many times. The Brazilians are our trade partners, and this is kind of not a great way to treat your friends.
Yeah. So I did a little riff on the program the other day based on something else Trump had said, that he's fine if the Chinese trade war goes on past Election Day. And I want to pose to you the same question we posed theoretically to people the other day. Imagine you get to Election Day in 2020 and the trade war is still going on and the tariffs have been in place for yet another year. How you doing there, President of the Delaware Steel Company?
Well, I think we'll be okay. I don't necessarily think it's a good policy. I don't support a trade war as a policy. I think that's a tactic. And I think that the steel market is – prices are running up, not necessarily because of the tariffs, but because people are optimistic that we will have a trade agreement. I don't know that it's necessarily possible, but Nancy Pelosi wants a deal. I'll tell you that. And so everybody does want a deal. Whether they could live with each other's deal is a whole other story.
Are you at, so at the end of the day, are you hopeful and optimistic, or are you just, you know, we'll see what tomorrow brings?
Kai, we are good friends for a long time. I'm the eternal optimist. I believe in manufacturing in America. I believe that this too shall pass. It's horrible. It feels uncomfortable. If you turn on the television during the day, it's worse than your worst soap opera.
Yeah. Lisa Goldenberg, she is the president of the Delaware Steel Company in Pennsylvania. Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time. We'll talk to you soon.
Happy holidays to everyone. Thank you.
A quick follow-up to the program yesterday before we move on. Our explainer that we did on first-time claims for unemployment benefits, which, as we said, is more than just an indicator of how many people are filing for benefits. It's kind of a confidence thing, really, how willing people are to wade through all the paperwork you got to do to get unemployment checks as a measure of how hopeful they are of getting a job. Anyway, first-time claims fell last week, so maybe if they're not doing the paperwork, they're feeling better about their prospects. Who knows? On Wall Street today, pretty close to break even. To be honest, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. A number, a letter, and a couple of news items with which to set up this next story. Five is the number, G is the letter. You put them together, and you get 5G wireless, the new thing in internet that is supposed to change the way the world works. This week, the Federal Communications Commission announced a $9 billion subsidy program to bring 5G to rural parts of the country. That's item number one. Item number two is that T-Mobile is set to roll out its 5G service nationwide any day now, which is great, if you believe. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
T-Mobile has been busy hyping the 5G network that it launched on Monday.
It's 5G ultra-wideband.
With massive capacity.
And ultra-fast speeds.
Sounds incredible. Problem is, a T-Mobile spokesperson told reporters those ultra-fast speeds are only going to be on average 20% faster than what customers have now.
5G is 80% marketing and 20% technology.
Gigi Sohn is a senior fellow in technology, law, and policy at Georgetown University.
The hype around this technology is enormous. And also the hype around needing to win a so-called race around 5G.
Telecom companies and politicians are pushing the claim that we have to beat China to 5G. But Philip Barenbroek, policy director of the telecom advocacy group Public Knowledge in D.C., says a lot of the country isn't wired with the fiber optic cable that networks need for 5G.
If you live in an area that doesn't have access to 4G LTE right now, you're not getting 5G anytime soon.
And wireless providers have been exaggerating how much the country has 4G service right now. All five members of the Federal Communications Commission were on Capitol Hill today to talk about a recent investigation that found Verizon, T-Mobile, and U.S. Cellular lied about 4G coverage in official filings. Christopher Mitchell, head of community broadband at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, says companies tell regulators one thing and Wall Street another.
And many of us say you should listen to what they tell Wall Street because they're not allowed to lie to Wall Street. They are allowed to lie to the regulators.
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai said yesterday there would be no punishment for those telecom companies. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The generally accepted figure for total outstanding student debt in this economy is something close to $1.5 trillion. That, one imagines, was the motivation behind a new proposal from Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. It would let people use some of their 401k or IRA savings to either pay for college or pay off student debts without extra taxes or penalties. One does not have to be a congressional scholar to know this bill will probably linger for a while and then just fade away. But Paul's proposal isn't the first to suggest that 401ks might be used to pay for all kinds of non-retirement spending. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on the retirement account as bank account.
The penalty for an early withdrawal is 10%, plus whatever tax you owe on that money. Lawrence Kotlikoff is an economics professor at Boston University. He says a penalty-free and tax-free withdrawal, like the one Senator Paul's plan would allow, could make it easier to pay off expensive debt.
And the safest investment in the world is to pay off high interest rate loans.
Federal student loan rates can run as high as 7%. And Kotlikoff says you can't count on making that back in a 401k, so paying off an expensive loan can be a better decision. Every year, people withdraw 1.5% of their retirement assets early, says Alicia Monell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
The implications of that, and the fact that it happens every year, is that people end up with balances that are 20% less than they would have been if these leakages hadn't occurred.
I think it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
That's Blair Ducanet, investment advisor at Ritholtz Wealth Management. She says even without a penalty, raiding your retirement account means you'll lose out on compound interest.
Doesn't seem like good policy in the long run to sacrifice future savings for retirement for a short-term solution to student loans.
And that's if you're fortunate enough to have a 401k to begin with. Damon Jones is an economist at the University of Chicago. He's been looking into early withdrawal rates across age groups.
People who are under 35, less than 50% appear to be covered by the types of accounts where you can make those withdrawals.
Jones says those people are the ones with bigger student debt burdens. They'd be less likely to benefit from using retirement funds to pay off student loans. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This next story you're about to hear, if you're a leave-it-to-the-last-minute holiday shopper counting on your package delivery company of choice to get something quickly from point A to stocking B, this one's for you, and you can't say you weren't warned, because this year, thanks to a late Thanksgiving, there is less time than usual to get everything done, which means the heat is on at FedEx, UPS, and the Post Office. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that one.
Come back with me to days of Christmas past, 2013 to be exact, when Thanksgiving came late in November and shippers got overwhelmed by bad weather and a glut of last-minute Christmas packages. The result was a public relations debacle.
UPS and FedEx, which also saw some delays, blamed the delivery delays on what they call a perfect storm.
Angry customers took to social media to complain the Grinch that stole Christmas wore brown. The color of UPS.
Yeah, ouch. Since then, UPS has opened 6 new automated super hubs, FedEx has added new handling equipment, and the U.S. Postal Service has invested in scanners. Now, they'll face a test again, with Thanksgiving having fallen late in November, leaving 6 fewer shopping days before Christmas. And that means shoppers and shippers have to move fast.
Consumers want it there on time. They do, all throughout the year, but more importantly right now.
Shlomo Ratcliffe owns a UPS store franchise in Burbank, California. He's had a sign on his counter since mid-November letting customers know about Christmas shipping deadlines.
Generally, the majority of the public waits till the last minute. And now with one less week, we're planning and expecting a bigger rush than normal.
UPS has also sent yearly emails and social media messages about shipping deadlines. U.S. Postal Service spokesperson Kim Frum says the post office is getting out the word, too.
A direct mail campaign to more than 100 million homes should have been received before Thanksgiving or by Thanksgiving.
USPS does that every year, but this year's shortened holiday season comes as we're collectively shopping online about twice as much as we did in that fateful Christmas season of 2013.
A lot of the expectations of consumers regarding speed of shipping have been driven by Amazon.
New York University's Arun Sundarajan studies how technologies transform business. He says shippers are feeling the pressure to deliver quickly because retailers are feeling it.
And for a smaller retailer, keeping up with that kind of expectation is incredibly hard.
UPS, FedEx, and the Postal Service each expect to ship around 30 million parcels a day at the peak of the holiday season just before Christmas. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They got a car for Christmas, and it was the worst gift they'd ever been given.
When television ads might not be totally true. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 28 points today, about a 10%, 27,677. The NASDAQ up 4 points, less than a 10%, 85.70. The S&P 500 also up 4 points, about a 10%, 31.17. Good news for clothing retailer Express, which released surprisingly good earnings figures today. The company's stock soared 27% as it beat revenue expectations in the third quarter. On the losing side today, L Brands, parent company of Victoria's Secret and Pink, which gave back 3.3%. Chewy, the online pet store, jumped more than 6% as Morgan Stanley reported underappreciated growth in pet owning, particularly by millennials and Gen Z. Go figure that one out. United Airlines announced Oscar Munoz is going to step down as CEO. Shares down a third of 1%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Global trade is complicated. We are just going to stipulate that. Competing interests, who finds a market for what and where, and then sells it to whom at what price, it gets messy in a hurry. That, long story made very short, is what got us the World Trade Organization, the generally recognized arbiter of what's fair in world trade. Until December the 10th, that is. After next Tuesday, one of the most critical parts of the WTO is going to stop working. The appellate body, it's called. You can think of it as a Supreme Court of trade. It's effectively going to be no more. The Trump administration has blocked appointment of any new judges to the appellate body. And yes, the United States and any other member do have veto power. So after the 10th, when two judges' terms expire, there won't be enough of them left to keep it running. Marketplace's Bree Benishore explains why all of this matters.
The U.S. is basically about to starve the World Trade Organization's highest body to death.
It's a crisis not only of dispute settlement, but it is effectively an existential crisis for the WTO itself.
Jeff Schott is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. The appellate body is the highest trade court on the planet. It's where cases from lower down in the WTO are appealed. Once it is out of the picture, there will be no final say when one country sues another. Cases can be kept in legal limbo, frozen in time.
That will have a corrosive effect on the WTO as an institution.
Without a court to settle things, countries who don't like lower court rulings will just end up fighting it out through trade wars or bare-knuckled negotiation. And Schott says not only will the WTO stop being a place for countries to settle disputes, it won't really make sense for countries to go to the WTO for other things, like negotiating new agreements on how to deal with modern issues like digital trade or labor rights. Rachel Brewster is a law professor at Duke.
So it basically really undermines the idea in the WTO that it is a rule of law system. Because no longer will there be a way to determine what the law is and how it should be applied to a certain case, at least not in a binding way.
So why is the Trump administration doing this? On one level, the U.S. is mad over administrative issues. It takes too long for cases to be decided. Certain procedures aren't always followed at the WTO. But ultimately, it comes down to sovereignty. Jennifer Hillman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and used to serve on the WTO appellate body.
The United States' basic complaint is that the WTO appellate body is not supposed to be able to take away rights that the United States had when the WTO agreements were put together in 1995.
The U.S. loses about half the cases it's involved in. In some of those cases, according to the U.S., the appellate body infringed on rights the U.S. says it never agreed to give up. In particular, the WTO has at times tried to limit how the U.S. punishes countries it accuses of dumping cheap products into its markets.
A lot of the rest of the world looks on this and thinks, well, it's just the United States having sour grapes.
Previous administrations have had similar objections, and some allies have expressed sympathy with some U.S. procedural concerns. But none have taken it as far as the Trump administration in terms of crippling the WTO's ability to function. And there's a reason for that, says Hillman.
There's no question that some of this is driven by the fact that I think the Trump administration believes that the United States is better off under a power-based system.
That is to say, the U.S. is the largest consumer market in the world. It's better off, the rationale goes, using its might to get what it wants rather than being subject to an international institution. Basically, to go back to the world before the WTO existed. That idea is a mistake, says Jeffrey Schott at the Peterson Institute.
That system failed. Disputes that involved big powers like the United States and the European Union couldn't be resolved.
The administration has already started to conduct some trade policy outside of the WTO system, the trade war with China, for example. According to the Tax Foundation, the OECD, and the IMF, that's dragged down economic growth estimates for the U.S., China, and the entire global economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Television ads are fake. I mean, we all know that, right? Especially car ads. Those long, stunningly beautiful shots of endless drives on the most picturesque coastlines you can imagine, or a Jeep or something climbing steep hairpin turns up a ski slope or something. Here's another one. A holiday morning, snow on the driveway, and a brand new car parked out front, complete with a giant red bow. I mean, nobody does that, right? Here's Marketplace's Jack Stewart.
The idea of tugging at heartstrings rather than that traditional buy, 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 massive discount style of car ads goes back to Lexus. That brand's December to Remember holiday ads have been running for 20 years.
The Lexus December to Remember sales event is going on now through January 2nd.
So this year, make sure you get the gift you really want.
I thought, where better to look into this than a place where I was surrounded by flashy new metal, the LA Auto Show, which is where I met up with Carl Brower of Kelly Blue Book.
The idea was essentially to try to get people to think that maybe a car purchase during Christmas is the perfect gift, and you know, celebrate these holidays by having a great big bow on a car.
The Lexus sedans at the booth behind us start at $38,000, so it's a pretty nice present. And the company says the ads work. In 1998, December was Lexus's 10th best-selling month. By 2000, it was the top. Nowadays, Lexus is not the only one hoping to move cars around the holidays. GMC's Black Friday commercial showed a His and Hers red and blue SUV and pickup.
One for you,
and one for me.
I love it.
Oh, actually, that was supposed to be for me.
I love it.
Gifts that start at $270 a month, according to the ad. Consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow is author of Decoding the New Consumer Mind. She says auto companies and dealers recognize that people indulge each other and themselves in the holidays. Spending's in the air, and they're primed to buy.
They not only treat other people to gifts, but really self-gifting and treating is much higher in December than any other month of the year.
And the figures show they are buying cars. Rachel Petuski is senior manager for research at Cox Automotive Mobility. She says over the last 6 years, sales of luxury vehicles have spiked at the end of the year.
So it makes complete sense that they're the ones that are offering these year-end sales events because they're wanting to trigger an even higher consumer demand for purchases before year-end.
Vehicle sales ticked up 2.2% in December last year. Some of that year-end increase is because dealers do give good deals as they look to meet targets and move old model year cars. But if you think buying a car as a gift is going to make someone really, really happy, well, Kit Yarrow says it might not work out that way.
Every holiday season, I interview consumers about, like, what's the best gift you've ever been given? And my favorite is, what's the worst gift you've ever been given? And I've had two people say that they got a car for Christmas and it was the worst gift they'd ever been given, which sounds, you know, sounds very odd, right?
She says typically people like to be involved in the choice and the purchase of cars. And of course, if it's the family car, it's not really so much a gift as something that will just have to be paid for every month for the next few years. And even if you are tempted to splurge on a new vehicle, you can't rely on that bow. Eric Lyman of True Car says his brother-in-law bought a car for his wife, and the dealer had run out of giant red ribbons.
He was pretty disappointed. You know, the car was a white car, so the beautiful contrast. I mean, it was the ultimate Christmas gift, right? This big snowy white vehicle without the red bow.
So if you do want the full fantasy car gifting experience this year, make sure you have the red ribbon all tied up too. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
July is far and away the busiest travel month of the year. But come November and December, when the weather's cold, the days are short, and you're running out of calendar to use your time off, a lot of people take vacation, which makes this a good time to revisit Automatic Reply, our series about some of the more creative out-of-office messages that we have come across.
Hello. My little ruse of leaving my car in the parking lot, my winter coat on my chair, and an open highlighter on my desk has failed. And I must now formally declare that I am, in fact, on paid time off through Tuesday morning. I am also walking, cold, and unable to highlight important documents. Lesson learned.
That was David Curcio in Kildare, Illinois with that one. Tell us about an out-of-office message you've seen, would you? Or maybe that you've heard. You can do it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today to the oil markets we go, the Saudi oil market to be specific. Saudi Aramco, the state-owned conglomerate over there, set the price for its much-anticipated initial public offering today, 32 Saudi rials a share. That's about $8.53 a piece, the high end of the range, which would value the IPO at about $25.5 billion, the company itself at about $1.6 trillion. Shares will trade on the Riyadh Stock Exchange. By the way, U.S. benchmark crude, meanwhile, flat Today in New York, $58.43 a barrel. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 28 points today, 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 4 points, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 also up 4 points, also about 0.1%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Heron Bekela are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.